Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing great.
You know, this is a very special program we're doing tonight. Do you know why?
No, I do not.
It's
some
a show
round
about
number
the future, and it's actually taking place 1 hour in the future.
Okay, explain that to our audience.
for everyone who followed the Blog Talk Radio timing for the show, somehow we got off for an hour. I know I set this up to begin at 8 o'clock Mountain Time tonight, but once in a great while, Blog Talk Radio is still beta after all these years. We have this little time zone issue, and they decide that another time zone would be more appropriate, and somehow the show got set for 7 o'clock Mountain Time. So it was all set to go an hour earlier than we were set to go, and Stephen and I were chatting casually with about 20 minutes to go from our perspective before the show was supposed to start when I noticed that, according to Blog Talk Radio, we should already be 40 minutes into it, but he deftly got in there. Well done, my friend, and got us back on track.
Yeah, I was a little afraid that we'd have a little trouble with that, but it turned out okay. So, you know, that's a good thing about Blog Talk Radio. When there is a glitch, often it doesn't last, and we've managed, all these shows, you know, it's kind of a regular thing to have some sort of glitch at some point in the show, but it never completely derails us, you know, and I say that while knocking on wood. I might lose Phil for a second. That's happened a few times. And, Phil, you've lost me a couple of times. We just
Sure.
call back in, and the other person just keeps talking. So,
well, we've had guests who, like, through the magic of Skype, have, like, disappeared for long periods of time and then kind of come rolling back, and all kinds of interesting things that have happened over the years. But we always get it back on track. And my guarantee to you, the listening audience, is that if we ever do completely lose it and the show just doesn't happen, we'll be back the next day, the next week, something. We'll always come back because, by golly, we enjoy it.
Yeah.
That's just our commitment to our listeners. So, we got a lot to talk about this evening, kind of a big, weighty philosophical topic. Before we get into that, anything interesting going on that you'd care to share?
Huh. Well, just kind of looking forward to getting out in the great outdoors this weekend, taking my sons out camping with the Boy Scouts, and we have a good time doing that. We usually get in a big hike, weather permitting, and it's a lot of fun. So I guess that's the big thing I'm getting prepared for. Spent a little time this afternoon getting packed up for it. So.
Now, there's parts of the country where I guess people do go camping in the winter, but it's a very specific kind of thing. There are people who, like, in the winter will go up into the mountains in Colorado and put tents up and, you know, prove that all this, like, subarctic gear works and so forth. Now, this is not that extreme, living where you live. Is that right?
Not really. It will probably be, you know, low 40s. You know, our low will be in the 40s at nighttime, you know, maybe the upper 40s. Now, when it's in the 40s here, that's a little bit colder than in some places like in Colorado. If it were in the 40s, that might almost feel warm because, you know, it's dry there.
Right.
The atmosphere is dry. Here, you know, it's, you're going to have like 95% humidity. I'm not even exaggerating. When you're in the 40s with that kind of humidity, it feels a lot colder. But you know, it's not extreme type camping usually. Well, we've done that. We've camped out a couple times where it got very, very cold. Actually, had to get up out of my tent in the middle of the night one time and build up the fire and get warmed up. That's pretty cold when you actually have to get out of your sleeping bag, get out of your tent, and
you
get
build
to the
fire. Yeah, you're cold
yeah,
then,
yeah.
For sure.
That's cold, and it was down in the 20s, in the low 20s, maybe upper teens, and it was pretty good. That was a pretty cold trip. Not expecting anything like that this weekend, so that'll be fun.
Well, now Sally is boasting that she enjoyed swimming today in an outdoor pool with low 70s today in Arizona. And they've had below 10% humidity. So, Sally, all I have to say is come back to us in the summer. When you're ready to spend a summer out there in Arizona, then we want to hear all about it, okay?
Sally is a fair-weather Arizona.
She is a fair-weather resident of two states, and it's a brilliant strategy that people have adopted. I applaud her. Okay, so
that's awesome.
we've got a big one tonight. We're going to be talking about Mr. Stephen Hawking himself and his most recent book. You know, there's an interesting thing about Stephen Hawking. I Googled him the other day looking for a couple of biographical facts just in support of the show we were doing. And there is a meme, and I don't think it's like a hoax, and I don't think it's like a conspiracy theory, but just like a false idea that's gotten promulgated out there that he died like 2 years ago. He didn't die, did he?
No. He was.
I'm like reading this story about how he died. I'm like, well, that's not true. He's not, you know. And you go to the regular news sites, and it's like, no, he's alive. He, you know, it's like, how could I have missed it when Stephen Hawking died? And I'm like, no, I didn't miss it. But it's the oddest thing. If you Google him, those sites come up, and it's kind of hard
strange
to get my head around where that comes from.
Yeah. No. I understand that his health is deteriorating, but he's still very much alive, and even did some interviews for this book here that it's just published, I think, in September.
I believe
and,
that's right.
Did,
yeah.
Yeah, and this last September, and he did some interviews at the time at the time it was just being published. So, and yes, I tell you, if any podcast mentions that, you know, when he does pass, it'll be this one. You know, and we'll no doubt make a big deal of the fact that he's passed when he does. But no, he's still very much with us.
Still with us, and we're very glad that he is. So let's talk about the grand design. Now, you've got the advantage on me, Stephen. I downloaded it to my iPhone the other day after you said that you were going to have a review of it this week, with the full intention of reading it between now and then. And I had plenty of time to read it. I just didn't have time to read it, if you know what I'm saying. So I haven't gotten very far into the book. I've sort of glanced through the entire thing, and I've started the first sections. Once you're reading it, it's a real page turner. I mean, I find it highly readable, as I have some of his earlier work, but I'm not through it, so I'm not in a position to critique the book, but I am in a position to discuss the ideas in it. Why don't we just jump right into it? First off, let's talk about the scope of the book. The marketing around it would have us understand that Stephen Hawking is now laying out for us the full theory of everything about everything. So, by way of explaining M-theory, we now have a complete picture of the universe. Is that your experience of reading the book?
Well, you don't get a complete picture of M-theory by reading this book.
Okay.
Stephen Hawking's first popular book was A Brief History of Time, and
right,
it sold a huge number of copies. And, you know, it's one of these books that everyone bought, everyone read and struggled through the first few pages of, and then put it on their bookshelf. And so that, you know, proudly displayed it on their bookshelf so that people would know that they're a smart person, but did not get through.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so the brief history of time, it just sold a lot of copies for a science book that had to do with that. And so a few years later, we got A Briefer History of Time.
Right.
And then A Universe in a Nutshell. Some of these books have titles that are indicating it's small. You can get through it. A Universe in a Nutshell. A Briefer History of Time. This time, they're not trying to downplay it with a title, at least. The title is The Grand Design. But he has a co-author, and this is the same co-author that helped him with his last book. This is Leonard Mlodinow. I've butchered his last name, but this particular writer.
Yeah, we never know. English-speaking people, we never know what to do with when you start a name with two consonants right next to each other like that. How does that work?
Anyway, Leonard, sorry for using your given name, he co-authored A Universe in a Nutshell, and I think that one of the things that he does as he's helping write these books is that he's throwing in things that keep the interest of a more average reader like you and I, Phil. So I found The Grand Design to be a much easier book to get through than A Brief History of Time. And but that said, does he answer some of the huge questions that he lays out? Why are we here? Why is there something rather than nothing? Not really. He says the answer is the M theory. He explains the M theory as best he can to a general audience, but it doesn't answer all those questions. No. So, but that said, great book. I highly recommend it, and we're going to get into some of the details that are in it here in just a second. So,
excellent. Well, in fact, let's do so. Let's talk a little bit about what the book does tell us about how the universe works. So it gives kind of a sketch of M theory. Is that right?
Well, just a little bit, and I like the way he put it here. I'm just going to quote this. M theory is not a theory in the usual sense. It is a whole family of different theories, each of which is a good description of observations only in some range of physical situations. It's a bit like a map. As is well known, one cannot show the whole of the Earth's surface on a single map. The usual Mercator projection used for the maps of the world makes some areas appear larger and larger the further north and south, and doesn't cover the north and south poles at all. To faithfully map the entire Earth, one has to use a collection of maps, each of which covers a limited region. The maps overlap each other, and where they do, they show the same landscape. And that's his metaphor for M theory. So, and it's a collection of theories. And, for example, I mean, you have classical Newtonian mechanics that describe how large objects work, and you've got quantum theory that describes very, very well how small things work. M theory kind of, it works these things together in a way that, this book does not really adequately explain M theory, but, Hawking says that it satisfies what we're looking for in an ultimate theory of everything. And he says it's as close as it's as close as we can get right now. And maybe we'll learn more with a Hadron Collider or something, but that's where we're at right now.
The question from the chat room from Sally is, does he combine gravity with quantum theory? I guess that's where the question can we get to quantum gravity here, unifying the forces and thus having at least a kind of a patchwork theory of everything, or does the book not go there?
He does go there. He talks about how he says that gravity is not like one of the forces of like the other forces. According to M theory, apparently gravity is just a warping of the space-time continuum, but it's not a force like the, you know, the nuclear force or magnetism or, you know, or the other forces that are explained by M theory. The reason we've had trouble working gravity into former theories is that we're trying to make a force out of it. He says it's not a force. It's in the sense that the others are. I thought it was interesting.
That is very interesting. So what is gravity if it's not a force?
Warping of space-time.
Oh, okay.
How is that different? A lot of this is going to be beyond me to explain, and I guess I just have to refer you to the book. But in theory, does take into account gravity. It's just treated differently from the other forces. So
okay, gotcha. So what else can you tell us about it seems to me that a lot is made about the idea of multiple universes. That seems to be kind of one of the drivers behind the thinking in the book. What does the grand design tell us about the idea of multiple universes that might be different from what we've heard before, or why are they crucial to an understanding of the arguments that are being made?
Let me start by saying how much Richard Dawkins loves this book and why.
Okay.
Richard Dawkins, he's you know a very
evolutionary
much
biologist, best-selling
evolutionary
author.
Biologist, but probably best known for being the king of atheists. You know, I'm being a little facetious, but he's the guy that's he's out there. You know, he's written several books. The God Delusion is probably I think the most recent. But he's the guy that's, you know, he's very much an outspoken atheist, and he's excited about this book, and he welcomes Hawking's position and says that Darwinism kicked God out of biology because, well, you know, basically biology was shown, you know, be a natural processes that you know that occurred over time, and it's a system that works fine on its own, according to Darwinianism, okay? But physics remained uncertain. Hawking is now administering the coup de grace, according to Richard Dawkins. Okay, so basically, and why would that be? Well, if you accept M theory, and part of M theory is a multiverse, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, all, basically at the moment of creation, all universes that could possible coexisted all at the same time and coexist even now. It's and most universes there's no chance for life to develop at all. You know, some universes do, and that small tiny set of universes that allow the creation of life, well, we're in one of them, and so that's part of M theory. And Richard Dawkins is basically saying, you know, because of that, we shouldn't be surprised that, you know, life developed. We shouldn't be surprised that this universe is so finely tuned to allow life to arise. You know, that's because all the universes that are possible exist, and we just, of course, we would be in one where a life is possible because we're here to observe it. And so, that's Hawking getting very excited about this book, and so, and that was part of how this book has been, you know, promoted. You come up in order to sell books, it's best to have something controversial to say. Learn that from Glenn Reynolds. He said that when he published his book Army of Davids, he was told, you know, you got to say something controversial, you know, so we can sell these books. You know, we see you talking about newspapers and how they have a shaky future. Why don't you say newspapers will be dead in a decade?
Or better yet,
in 5 years. And Glenn Reynolds just says, well, you know, I guess I'd probably sell books, but I don't happen to believe that. And so he refused to do it. And but his books sold pretty well.
Oh, him and his integrity. Jeez, that guy's tiresome, isn't he?
That's right. Exactly. anyway, and so I'm not saying Hawking, you know, went with the God is dead business to sell books. I think he probably really believes, you know, that he's, I don't know.
I don't want to get into
what he believes or doesn't believe.
Well, no, we're gonna get into that, but right now we're on parallel or multiple universes, but I think that I think you raise a really interesting point there, which is that the sensationalism around the publishing of this book, which by the way I was happy to pick up on in promoting this tonight's program, was hey, does this book disprove the existence of God? Right? I mean, that was the flap, right? That's what a lot of reviewers were saying. That's kind of what the news story was. Stephen Hawking has written this book and it disproves the existence of God. You know, whether he intended to say anything nearly that bald, right, is beside the point. Whether it was him or the publisher, somebody recognized the fact that is a very attention-getting idea. And from a book marketing standpoint, you got to say, well, it was highly effective because the book got all kinds of attention. Although I have to think that a new book from him that just talks about how relativity and quantum mechanics can be combined, to create a theory of everything similar to what you see with M theory, and the strong anthropic principle, which I guess this is a restatement of, right? This is
exactly, yeah.
Yeah, is derived from.
In fact, he says in the book that the multiverse concept erases the distinction between the strong and weak anthropic principle.
Oh, wow.
And so I had to think about that. You know, okay, what is the difference between the strong and weak anthropic principle? The weak anthropic principle is, we must be prepared to take into account the fact that our location in the universe is privileged to the extent that it's compatible with our existence. Okay?
Right.
The strong anthropic principle is basically saying the universe had no choice, but it must be such as to admit the creation of observers within it.
Right.
You've got a theory that says all universes are possible, then there's no distinction between strong and weak anthropic principle. I'm still fuzzy on that, but that's what he said.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
The idea that multiple universes allow for any possible universe, including a universe as finely tuned as ours, including the one where we happen to sit, but that's only because that's just the one where we ended up. We could have been in any of the, I guess it's not, is it infinite or huge finite number of possible universes? I'm not sure which is the actual answer there, but it's a vast number of, actually you shouldn't say possible, it's a vast number of coexisting universes, right? We're just one drop in this whole ocean of universes. That's the idea. And to say that one's possible and the other one's not is to miss the point. In this explanation, they've all been realized. Is that right?
Yes. And another interesting thing. He's saying that we exist on a probability wave in our presence right now. Not only is the future always changing, and the future is certain probabilities, but even our past going back, we is based on what's the most probable way of getting us to this point. And that's kind of mind blowing. Think about that a little bit. The past is not even is set in stone according to this theory. It's just what's the most probable set of circumstances to get us to this point in time.
Wow.
That's pretty wild.
So an equally valid set of circumstances could have gotten me to this point, could have gotten us to this point, and it's, oh, no, that just makes my head hurt to think about that. So,
yeah, exactly.
So it's variable which one is actually the past.
Exactly. And it might change from time to time. that's what I take away from it.
Let me ask this in a really dumb way, okay? And just to make sure I've got the idea. So,
okay,
I had some turkey sausage and eggs for breakfast this morning, right? Today.
Okay.
Wednesday.
All right.
Now, are you saying
good.
that, low carb, right? So are you telling me that tomorrow it's possible that today I had, like, toast for breakfast?
Well, and the reason...
right? Like,
and,
like the past and, itself would somehow line up differently behind the present? Is that what they're actually saying, or they're just saying it could have gone differently?
Now, the probability of the past changing, it's something that recent and that important to how you got to this, how you got to tomorrow, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The probability is so remote as to not even, you know, not even worry about it, okay? Because that's the recent past. But, you know, as far as what happened a billion years ago in a far galaxy, that could change fairly regularly. I'm guessing I understand it well enough to comment on it like that. But that's what he's saying, that even the past is not concrete, that we exist on a probability wave. What's the most probable way of getting us here? So there you are.
So here's Sally kicking in with where I was going to take this eventually anyway, so I don't mind. We'll just digress because I love this. She says, the weirdest one, read in the anthropic principle, is the omega point in which our extremely powerful descendants reach back in time to order the universe so they and we will be able to exist. Now, that brings up the whole question of the simulation hypothesis, the idea we've discussed prior to this show tonight on several occasions, that the universe we're living in might just be some enormous simulation being run by beings in another universe who were just kind of interested in witnessing it or as an experiment or for whatever reason as entertainment. That's one of these kind of outlying explanations for how it is that we come to be here. Another is the biocosm hypothesis, the one that suggests that universes are getting more sophisticated and that each universe, because of the information in it, is giving birth to that next generation of universes. We touched on that most recently in our discussion in The World Transformed with John Smart, which, by the way, part one of that discussion will be on this Saturday for those who'd like to refresh their memories with the really kind of deep, just cosmic concepts. So let's take both those ideas and Sally's to boot, the one where you've got the really interesting thing where the ancestors are reaching back across time to put the universe in place such that we're here. Are any of those compatible with what you're reading in The Grand Design, and if so, what does that do to Hawking's contention that the universe is completely self-explanatory and doesn't need a creator?
Sally's Alpha Omega Point novel. Is that the name of the novel, Omega Point?
I don't think it's not a novel. The Omega Point is discussed by, among others, Frank Tipler in The Physics of Immortality. It's actually a scientific theory.
Okay. It's according to what I understand of M theory, that would not be necessary. Our descendants reaching back in time and creating the universe so that we can all exist is not necessary any more so than, you know, Hawking thinks God would be necessary. That M theory is sort of self-explanatory. It all comes about by itself, and nothing else is needed. This multiverse is a little different from some concepts of the multiverse that I've, you know, heard of. I've heard of, like, multiverses existing like bubbles, and, you know, one here's a universe over here in a bubble, and over, you know, and over here is another one, and stuff like this. It's not like that. It's like all universes existing at once, at the same time, same place. There's to the extent you can talk about place, and we just and of course we would be within a universe that's compatible with life. So, am I getting to what you were talking about there?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. So, let me ask you something then. Let's go ahead and let's dust this one off. Does the book? Do you find the book persuasive on the kind of the key marketed point that there's no role in the universe for a creator, excepting the math, right, the physics as described? Do you think that is a fair conclusion to draw from the argument as made?
Maybe I should put it this way. If I were to accept everything written in this book, do I have to give notice to the church that I'm not going to be back?
I don't mean it quite that sharply, but okay, sure. You'll put it in those terms.
Okay.
If you're not going back to church, you actually don't have to give notice.
Yeah, okay. I got friends there.
That is a very conscientious backslider who lets them know.
Yeah, exactly. I won't be around again. I think that a believer can read this book and uh-huh. find it persuasive, and find it a fascinating read, and then put it down, pick up his Bible, and go straight to church, and not, there not being any contradiction.
But how can that be if the argument is that there's no role in the universe for a creator?
Well, put it to you this way. You can have a universe that is a fascinating and beautiful place that is explained well by M theory, and that still is not a satisfactory answer to me of how things got started. Okay, wouldn't it be a whole lot easier, Phil, for there to be nothing at all than for there to be everything, every possible universe? Okay, I mean, or any universe, or any one particle. I mean, wouldn't it have been easier for there to have been nothing at all? And so,
I agree. It would be. It seems like it would be a lot easier. Yes,
it'd be a whole lot easier for there to have been nothing ever at all than for there to be this fantastic universe. And so, I find that the existence of anything to be a miracle without end. And if we're going to talk about miracles, we might as well. There is a place for God, in my opinion, and there's a place for faith, and faith is not rocked by that. That's me. I very much enjoyed this book. Richard Dawkins is very happy about this book. He's happy about
it. Well, it's a book that both you and
me.
Richard Dawkins can enjoy. That's
that's exactly right. We both enjoyed it.
That's a nice thing.
For different reasons. Yeah,
well, here's Sally in the chat room. She's being a better devil's advocate than I can be. This is good. If the multiverse is infinite in time, going back forever, going forward forever, with every kind of universe being produced, God would not be needed. I have no need of that hypothesis, the scientist said. There would never be one point of creation in time or space. Would it be easier for there to be nothing instead of something? I'm not at all sure of that hypothesis. Oh, and my computer just went blank. It's possible that nothingness could be forever impossible. We're into the heavy philosophical waters now, and I really enjoy this kind of stuff. I can see that point too. The one argument is that I think both sides find ultimately all human minds find the notion of a completely self-existent entity confounding, because it has no referent in our experience. Everything
right.
else proceeds from a cause, and then you're going to say, but this universe or God is completely self-existent back all the way through all of time, et cetera. You know, and you can apply a lot of the same attributes either to the universe in the one argument, or to God then bringing the universe out in another argument. So one side might say you're just needlessly complicating it. You're saying with this God idea, right? You know, something is self-existent. We'll just let it be the universe, right? That would be the one side. But I think your argument's strong too. The argument is.
Yeah.
We are confounded by the notion of something rather than nothing. Something rather than nothing defies logic. We appear to have hit, if you will, a singularity, and beyond that singularity, a rational hypothesis, in your view, is a creator. So,
right.
I find both those arguments quite compelling.
Let me go back to Hawking's metaphor again. He mentioned that, we don't have any two-dimensional maps of the entire Earth that are satisfactory because the Earth is not the universe is not flat. The Earth is not flat. In order to faithfully map the entire Earth, you either have a series of maps or you just make a globe, right?
Right.
A globe is, an accurate map of the entire world. It works because the actual shape of the world is incorporated into that map. Okay, it's a spherical shape. Now, he talks about the M theory, family of theories. You have this part of the theory over here that accurately represents this set of circumstances. And here's another slightly different theory that overlaps that explains these circumstances. What if there is some underlying structure or shape to the universe or to God or whatever that is not yet understood? And so we're just kind of getting at with these theories. And if we really understood the underlying structure of it all, then we really could have, a one theory to cover it all, maybe that's what we got right now with the M theory family of theories is we got a bunch of maps that serve us well for the different things we observe, but we still don't have the structure underneath it. We don't have the spherical shape if it were the world. So
okay, well, so we're operating on incomplete knowledge still. Even with a candidate for the theory of everything. So let me hit you with a really hard hypothetical here, Stephen. I feel like I'm grilling you, like this is your master's thesis and you're being forced to defend it. So this is all in fun, you understand. But let's say we found more data, improved our theory. We have the shape of the universe understood now, and suddenly the light comes on and the notion of a self-existent universe is no longer confounding. Suddenly the universe is self-explanatory, even to your satisfaction.
I'd have to be a whole lot smarter to understand that.
I imagine
a world where we're all a lot smarter. And we can
I don't know how it would work that I would ever, like, be cool with a completely self-existent thing, because that just seems to be where my head bumps against the wall. But we're hypothetically, if that were proven, then would you say, okay, well, they've proved that God need not exist?
Well, saying that God need not exist is still not saying that God doesn't exist.
Granted, I phrased it carefully.
Yeah, and that's pretty much in one of the interviews that Hawking gave in promoting this book. They really kind of grilled him, and at one point he says, "Well, I can't disprove God." There's no theory to disprove God. I'm just saying that this particular theory or set of theories that we have that seem to answer a lot of the questions that we have very well and experimentally seems to be working out pretty well, that it's we have a self-contained universe that doesn't need any outside influence. That's what he was saying, and that's a whole lot different from saying there is no God. Now, what he believes or doesn't believe, he didn't go into that. So
he'll have to come on the show and talk to us about that.
Yeah.
And exactly. And if you're listening, sir, you're obviously welcome anytime.
Exactly.
We've got your album. We play your songs all the time. Huge fans. Okay, let me work this just a little bit further. I don't want us to beat a dead horse, but it's fun, I think, to once in a while let loose and talk about this stuff, because we usually avoid this, not because it's not important to talk about. I think it's refreshing to have a conversation about this, and I think it's one of the things that's really beneficial about the hype that surrounded that book is it got people thinking about that, and it got them talking about that issue. And I think, you know, it's good to it's good either to reconsider or just to consider what it is that you believe about these things and how these arguments kind of stack up in your head. But on the subject of disproving the existence of God, it certainly seems to me that they fall short of that. So that's my hype. I never thought that God would get disproved here on the program tonight. As far as demonstrating that God need not exist, ultimately that becomes a completely subjective set of statements, right? It's like, well, I don't, you know, what would mean God does need to exist? So I think that that people who read the book inclined to feel one way are going to find evidence supporting what they want to believe, or inclined to feel the other way might just say, as you did, right, that this is not persuasive to me along those lines. But though while not persuaded, it's a great opportunity to kind of, I don't know, sharpen our thoughts along these lines a little bit. Having said all that, it seems to me that in the book, in as much as I've not read the entire thing, but what I have read of it, it seems to me that Hawking is awfully hard on philosophy. And,
yeah, I saw that too. That was one of the first most controversial things he says in the book, very, very early in the book. I wanted to ask if you agree with that. You got the quote there, Phil, or should I read
it? Go ahead.
Okay. Did the universe need a creator? Most of us do not spend most of our times worrying about questions like that, but almost all of us worry about them at some point or another. Traditionally, these are questions for philosophy. But philosophy is dead. Philosophy has not kept up with modern developments in science. So,
yeah. And there are those who take Hawking to task for his rather abrupt dismissal of philosophy. And I have not kept up with philosophy, so I certainly, you know, and I'm very behind on the science too. So I'm in no position to judge whether philosophy has kept up with science. And I can see you know, the argument. As Hawking made it in A Brief History of Time, which is that they've just kind of slipped off into this thing where all they do is talk about language, and you know, we want to talk about the meaning of existence and where it all comes from. We're dealing with those issues as physicists, and the philosophers are not. I think that's kind of interesting, but some of the criticism that has been levied against this book is that, you know, Hawking is brilliant on the physics, but when he gets off physics, he's, you know, a little bit tin-eared, perhaps, that maybe his knowledge is not as extensive as it is in his area of expertise, and that he makes some pretty sweeping statements that perhaps don't resonate as well as the talking about physics do. Now, I find that to be true when I hear him talk about extraterrestrial civilizations. I think he's right when he says that it's a very dangerous thing for us to do. But I think we noted in a blog post a while back that Stephen Hawking has just sort of recently come on board with recognizing the notion of accelerating change. And I think that in a lot of ways he's got probably some catching up to do where those kinds of subjects are concerned. And when I read a quote from him, which I found on the internet, so if this is an inaccurate quote, I'll take it with a grain of salt. But that he recently said in the, I don't know that his context was in the war or in the conflict between science and religion. Science will win. Definitely, the word science will win is what Hawking was quoted as saying. And you know, I find that kind of thinking significantly out of date. To me, it seems that that to suggest that that there's really a big conflict between the two is something that we dealt with in the past. I personally think if there's a conflict between which of the two bodies of thought explain the workings of the natural world and which of the two do we rely on, basically to build our technology, to build our civilization on, you know, it's science, right? The science has significantly won that war. Now, the other of the two has traditionally been what we've used to build our, you know, our moral infrastructure, and a good deal of our culture derives from that. But if you look at just, you know, what's our go-to discipline for making sense of the world, you know, I think science has already won. I don't think that there's a future where science wins over religion. I think that probably never actually had to happen. I think that was an inevitability and a good outcome.
Well, I wanted to ask you specifically though, is the field of philosophy dead? The amount of money that's poured into big science by compared to say philosophy or other areas is huge. And I would say that, you know, a lot of the philosophy that we get these days it comes from people like Hawking himself. You know, I mean, you know, we see what you know, we you know, what the universe, how the universe works, and then we build our philosophy from that, if, to the extent, you know, the philosophy is still around, I guess. And perhaps philosophy also bridges the gap between religion and science. So, those who have dedicated their life to science, few of them have any religion at all. I think that's probably accurate. But most of the rest of us do have some beliefs or another, and I think philosophy helps bridge the gap between the two. So.
Right. Well, initially, science was a subset of philosophy. It was natural philosophy, I think they called it. And
yeah.
But I think that's a category error, okay? And I think talking about a conflict between religion and science is another category error. And one of the things I've observed in the early parts of the book is something that Sally has referenced here on the chat room recently, is this notion that religion, belief in God, existed primarily to account for natural phenomena, and it's gotten less and less effective at that, so it matters less and less over time, and science has gotten better and better at that, so it's more important over time. Well, part of that's true. The part that religion has gotten less and less effective at that, and that science has gotten better at it, but that initial assumption that that's what religion existed for in the first place, I think is incorrect. I don't believe that that our primitive ancestors developed systems around religion to account for the natural world. I think that's an add-on to systems that they developed to account for kind of this, you know, this profound mystery of being that we're talking about when we talk about coming up against the idea of something that exists on its own. Here's my analogy. I call this the 1970s cartoon analogy on science and religion. And I don't know, Stephen, you might have watched some of these cartoons. There was this phase, like in the early and mid 70s, where Saturday morning cartoons suddenly got very moralistic, and the end of each show would have like one of the characters come back and talk about the conflict that occurred and like the lesson that we learned today. Have you ever seen a show that does that?
I prefer Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote.
Same here. I'm more a Looney Tunes kind of a fan. But it's like when they were making new content, right? But you've seen shows like that, right? Where they come and say,
well,
you know, today Jimmy
like,
learned.
When I got a little older, there was about the time that I was putting away cartoons, it seemed like G.I. Joe and some of those other things, and knowing's half the battle and that kind of thing. At the end of the show, they always come up with some lesson or something.
Yeah, here's the lesson that we're demonstrating from the cartoon today. Now, if you were to look at those shows, if you were to take a sample of those shows, you know, no context, you don't know much else about what they were doing, you could look at that and say, ah, I see. So Saturday morning cartoons were this medium that was invented back in the middle part of the 20th century in order to teach children moral lessons.
No.
And no. The Saturday morning cartoons were this medium invented to sell advertising space, to sell cereal toys, right? I mean, they were to sell G.I. Joes. They were there to entertain kids long enough to keep them watching the commercials. That's what they actually exist for. And the moral lessons were an add-on to the actual driving force behind Saturday morning cartoons. And I really think things like there's this wonderful mythological story at the beginning of the Grand Design, talking about how some lake was formed, I think somewhere in the Northwest, and the Crater Lake, actually. The Native Americans have a terrific story about the king of the underworld and the king of the higher heaven, and I didn't get all the details, but all of this mythological like drama then accounts for the natural phenomenon. See, I think that is like very entertaining for people, and that people get a kick out of that kind of stuff. But I really believe that most of that stuff is just an add-on to a system of thought that would have existed with or without those kind of to me, those stories are like the little moral lessons that got added to cartoons. I don't think that religion ever required that it be offering up explanations of the natural world. I just think it's something that I don't know, people started doing with it and had a tendency to do when they were trying to create maybe the original theory of everything. They were trying to make everything accountable under kind of like one metaphysical umbrella. So they would say, oh, well, you see, the gods did that, right? You know, the reason we have seasons is because one of the gods took a maiden, you know, from heaven down into the underworld, and her mother's sad, and so the world gets cold. The scientific observation that the seasons were reliable had already been made, and the story got added just because, it's kind of a fail, I would say, right? I think that was something that was added to religion, wasn't needed, and that is slowly being, actually very rapidly being removed. So in fact, what you have there, if I'm correct, is science over time improving religious thought, because it's kind of purifying it down to what it really needs to be.
I just throw this out. The real reason they started putting the moral lessons at the end of the cartoons?
Uh-huh.
Congress put a requirement on television stations that they had to have a certain amount of educational programming. And they could, and by tagging on that little 30-second thing, they could count the whole cartoon as an educational program.
Wow,
and,
that's awesome.
And it boards their hours. Anyway,
that's
I'm sorry.
Great. So Fat Albert
to
Cosby
with
Kids,
anything you just,
that was an educational show. That's good to know.
Yeah, you turned Transformers and G.I. Joe into educational programming.
That's right. We were learning as we go.
Okay.
I think that does it. That's all I have to say on this subject. Well, actually, I have one more thing to say. Along those same lines, I'm sorry, Stephen, maybe you have some parting, concluding thoughts you want to make.
No, go ahead.
The Grand Design. Related to the idea that that maybe Hawking is stronger on the physics than he is on the cultural critique. Did you catch the Golden Globes Sunday?
No, I did not.
Sounds like a huge digression, but I swear I'm going to bring it back. Ricky
okay.
Gervais was the host, and there's been some controversy about his hosting.
Oh, yeah, I heard about the controversy. Go ahead.
Because he was pretty merciless to the crowd there. He was
yeah.
pretty hard on them. And
said something about Scientology, I think, didn't he?
Well, he took a real shot at John Travolta and Tom Cruise, and it was harsh. Now I look at that and I say, actually, I'm okay with it, right? I think, okay, these people get paid an awful lot of money to do stuff that most of us wouldn't even think of as actual work. They get tremendous adulation for what they do, and then they all got together to give each other awards, and somebody was mean to them, and now they're upset. I'm like, you know what? There's got to be bigger problems in the world than that.
Yeah, exactly.
but his parting shot, there's some controversy around this. He was saying good night and thank you, and I want to thank everyone, and thank this, thank that, and I want to thank God for making me an atheist, was his very last word, and then show's over. So there's this controversy about whether that was that an appropriate thing for him to say, was that over the line, was that good, was that bad, and here's my critique of that joke. And tell me if you tell me. First off, what do you think? Is it cool for him to say that if he wants to say it?
It's a little bit like the joke where Bush is able to make a local call from hell to the United States because you know the world, you know the United States has gone to hell under Obama. it's a bipartisan joke.
Now that
joke.
One I've not heard. But
okay,
but
well, it's a bipartisan
premise.
Joke. You know, Bush is in hell, but Obama's taking the country there too.
Yeah, well, actually, so, that's a pretty good. That slams everybody, so it's kind of.
Yeah, exactly. Saying that I thank God that I'm an atheist is sort of it's a tweak to both the atheists and the theists. Okay, it's you know. I don't see it as particularly as particularly inappropriate or anything. It's just sort of, you know.
No, I think I think it's fine to make the
it's
fine if he wants to make the joke if he wants to. Here's my critique of that joke. I think that is a lame joke. I think that thank God I'm an atheist is the take my wife please of atheist humor. So that joke's been around forever, okay? You know, I Rob Reiner made that joke on All in the Family like 40 years ago, okay? So all I'm asking, and I don't think this is too much, if you're going to tweak the world with your, you know, with your atheist humor,
edgy humor,
give us a good
edgy.
Joke. I want to laugh when I hear a good atheist joke, so please,
yeah.
You know, as Jon Stewart always says, if you're going to do this stuff, bring the funny, right?
Exactly. Well, you know, I tell you, for some reason, doing award shows must be extremely hard to do well because
yes.
You see so few well-done award shows. So, you know.
That's true.
Yeah.
And, well, certainly he got everybody's attention. So, you know,
well, maybe that was the point.
That
if I can't be funny, at least I'll, you know, I'll leave people talking about me. If I can't be funny, I'll be controversial. So
there it is.
Maybe that was.
Yeah, I think that's too that is too low for a comedian to aim. I think they should always try to be funny. But that's me, and we've now swung way far of our discussion. So unless you have anything else to say on the Grand Design, we should probably talk about what our music is this evening.
Okay. Well, I thought you know since we're talking about Hawking's book, that we would bring Glorious Dawn back. We've actually had in the history of the show, Phil, we've had two songs that made reference to Stephen Hawking, and one was A Brief History of Pudding,
yes.
Which was mildly offensive, and so I'm not going to play it again. So instead of that one, we're gonna play A Glorious Dawn, which everybody seems to love, including you and I. So
A Glorious Dawn, Carl Sagan, Stephen Hawking, and who's the actual artist that put that together?
A guy by the name of John Boswell. He auto-tuned this song. He you know, it was both Hawking and Carl Sagan talking. You know, and he makes music out of it. It's beautiful.
Boswell, Sagan, and Hawking, A Glorious Dawn. Thanks, Stephen, for getting that together. Thanks, chat room. It was fun as always. Everyone listening to the program, thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We're back on Saturday with part one of part 10 of The World Transformed, another archive show on Monday, and back on again live next Wednesday evening. Until then, live to see it.
I'm not very good at singing songs, but here's a try. From scratch, you must first invent the universe. Space is filled with a network of wormholes. You might emerge somewhere else in space, somewhere else in time.
The sky calls to us. We do not destroy ourselves. We will one day venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits. Not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The writing of the Milky Way cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truths of exquisite interrelationships of the awesome machinery of nature.
I believe our future depends powerfully on how well we understand this cosmos, in which we float like a mote of dust in the
morning sky, but the brain does much more than just recollect. It compares, synthesizes, analyzes, it generates abstractions.
The simplest thought, like the concept of the number one, has an elaborate logical underpinning. The brain has its own language for testing the structure and consistency of the world. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy remains. A morning filled with 400 billion suns, the rising of the Milky Way. The sky calls to us. If we do not destroy ourselves, we will one day venture to the stars.
Have wondered about the universe. Did it stretch out forever, or was there a limit? From the Big Bang to black holes, from dark matter to a possible Big Crunch, a remnant of the universe today is full of strange sounding ideas.
How lucky we are to live in this time, the first moment in human history when we are, in fact, visiting other worlds. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns, the rising of the Milky Way. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns, the rising of the Milky Way. Of the cosmic ocean. Recently we've waded a little way up, and the water seems inviting.